Okay, so hello. Most of you know me, but some of you may not. So my name is Achim Kemp. I teach this course this term, Fundamental Theory for Cosmology. And there is a homepage for this course, the address of which I wrote here. Notice that there is an S over there. If you only type this much, you get my homepage. If you add that, you get the homepage of this course. And I would recommend that you bookmark that if you want to take the course, because I will keep all information about the course updated on this. Especially the lecture notes will be regularly posted there. So this is the homepage itself. And let's just go through that homepage of the course just to get the basic organizational fact. So as a prerequisite of this course, I'm expecting that you've taken some quantum mechanics, preferably what physics calls quantum four, as an undergrad, or as a grad student, the AMATH 673. Also, some knowledge of general relativity is really assumed. I'm not going to really teach general relativity. So I assume at least some knowledge of it, but you won't need all that much of it, because the focus is really going to be on quantum field theory. Of course, the general relativity part of it will be very important, but technically not very complicated. Now, the timing of this course is a little bit unusual in that we start Tuesdays at 4 o'clock, but because of a conflict with the seminar, on Thursdays we start at 5 o'clock. Yes? You have a question? No? I saw you raise your hand. Okay. The course is always taught in this room, except for 1 week in March, I think, where we'll have to move to the Alice room. And it will be video linked to the University of Waterloo, this room, if there's demand for that, to the University of Guelph, if there's demand for that, and possibly also to other venues, for example, at the IQC, if there's demand for it, we can broadcast it there as well. Office hours, well, just let me know. Just let me know. So what about the content of this course? The subject of the course is quantum field theory for cosmology. Thanks. That's the title of the course. And it's really a course that starts from scratch as far as quantum field theory is concerned. But it's not going to be the usual kind of course of quantum field theory, on quantum field theory. Usually, quantum field theory is taught for the purpose of studying particle physics, particle collisions, particle production in collisions, the sort of thing that you need to understand the outcome of accelerator experiments. That's the normal type of quantum field theory. This course is going to have very little overlap with that. It's still quantum field theory, but at the beginning, the two subject areas, the areas of application will diverge quite significantly. Ordinary courses of quantum field theory focus on particle production, particle collisions. This course is going to focus instead on the field aspects of quantum fields and on the fluctuations of quantum fields and how they are influenced by the presence of curvature, in the case of gravity, and or horizon. So the focus is a very different one, but it is something. It is a topic that has been neglected a little bit in teaching at most universities over the past decades, I suppose, because the subject matter is not really all that new, except for the last few lectures that we will do. But it has been neglected because there used to be little experimental evidence to study quantum field theory in this way, to study its field aspects rather than its particle aspects, to study the vacuum fluctuations and the cosmological implications. Fortunately, that situation has changed. Over the past 10 years or so, cosmology has become a precision science, and the predictions of quantum field theory on curved space are thought to have been quite precisely confirmed. It's quite spectacular what can be predicted. In particular, the big upshot of all of this study is that we now believe that we understand what the origin of structure in the universe is. Of course, there's still doubt. You can always improve on the theory, but it's a rather precise theory that we have that is based on quantum field theory on curved space, which gives an explanation of where all of the structure in the universe came from. Basically, answers why there's something in one spot of the universe and nothing in another spot of the universe. What is the statistics of the distribution of matter and energy in the universe? How come it's not just all homogeneously spread out? How come that there is a particular kind of distribution of matter in the universe? And the key idea, which was first proposed in the 1980s, is that quantum fluctuations of fields were seeding the initial inhomogeneities in the universe. Basically, we are all quantum fluctuations. That's what it says. So the goal of this course is to study all about quantum fluctuations, especially when there's curvature and expansion and horizon. And eventually, we'll see how that calculation goes. How do you calculate from scratch how quantum fluctuations generate, first of all, a pretty much flat universe, which has, however, a particular spectrum of fluctuations that quite nicely matches the experiment.
Yes, that's right. Thank you. Yeah, I thought since the battery is full, it's not a problem, but this problem remains, of course.
Okay. Right, so here's a brief outline from first to second quantization, introduction to scalar quantum field theory. And that is pretty close to what one would usually do, or one could usually do it like that in the course of quantum field theory, even if your focus is particle physics. But then we will continue with the Unruh effect and quantization in curved space times. We will also come into path integral quantization of fields, and then study quantum fluctuations of fields, and even quantum fluctuations of the metric itself. So in a sense, it's going to be quantum gravity, in that sense that we will quantize small perturbations of a metric. And amazingly, we expect to be able to measure the predictions at some point.
Primordial gravitational waves would be the signature.
And in another sense that we will get to at the very end of the course, there is a sense in which fluctuations of scalar fields and fluctuations of the metric cannot really be separated, cannot really be distinguished completely because it's a matter of gauge, it's a matter of point of view, it's a matter of coordinate system, whether a fluctuation is entirely field, entirely metric, or a mixture of them. And this mixture, such a mixture of field fluctuations and metric fluctuations, has been measured. It is the, it is what caused, apparently, from all we know, the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. So in this sense, we've actually already seen fluctuations of the metric, only that we have not yet seen fluctuations that could only be that are 100% fluctuations of the metric. You've only seen a mixture of fluctuations of scalar fields and the metric. So that abstract theory we will apply to inflationary cosmology and the origin of structure in the universe. If time permits, we will add a few other topics. Lecture notes will be made available. Here are the lecture notes. You see, this is just a copy of the web page. Here are the lecture notes of the last time I taught it in winter 08. And the the new lecture notes will be improved versions of that. Maybe I will rearrange things a little bit, add a little bit here and there. But basically, if you look at those, you get a good idea of what we're going to do. And if you want to read ahead, this will work. I've already posted today's lecture over here. In this spot in the homepage, you will see all the lectures come up. And I usually, I hope to post them days before the actual lecture, before the actual class. But the latest, the evening before, I will post new classes. It depends on how many changes I do. Okay, now the lecture notes, when they are printed, fill a book like this. I have a few spare copies of the lecture notes of 2 years ago, and I will bring them along next time. If you want, you can just grab one. additional literature, there are three texts that I would recommend most. One is the textbook by Mukhanov and Vinitsky. Mukhanov is one of the original discoverers of cosmological inflation. This is a good book. It has a lot of problems and solutions as well in it. An earlier version of this used to be lecture notes that they posted freely available on the web. I have a copy of it, and you get at them if you type this web address right up to here, and then add text.pdf. You will see that while the lecture notes are very different from the actual book, the topics are very much aligned. And also, I have tried to stick to the notation and terminology of this book. So this book is really very much complementary to our lecture notes. Then other recommended texts are, in particular, the standard text by Birrell and Davies, and a less known but just as good book by Fulling. And later after class, you can have a look and browse through those books. I've asked the PI library to put all those three books on reserve. I don't know whether they have done so yet, but they should. Yep. Oh, I see. So do you. Okay. And then I added a few more sources of information here. There's a book by Little and Leith. There are two papers by Jacobson and Ford that are freely available online. Maybe we shouldn't go too much into the essay just yet. Maybe just read this at your own time. I've just collected some information about what I expect in an essay and what are essay topics. I've listed three essay topics here. One is Planck scale effects in inflationary cosmology. The idea there is to review literature on the problem of, or on the opportunity, perhaps, to measure quantum gravity effects in the cosmic microwave background. There's a huge number of papers on that, and you can review what's going on there. Another topic is a sonic analog of black holes and Hawking radiation, which is also a very active area nowadays. Then a review of inflationary cosmology, and maybe I will add another one or two topics with literature. The essay is expected to be 50 to 20 pages or so. And the essay will count 60% towards the final grade, and the final exam will count 40%. This course is part of a group of four graduate courses that the physics and the applied math departments have coordinated in Waterloo, such that the four courses complement another rather than competing with it. So there is this course, which is general relativity for cosmology, which I taught last term, which is classical general relativity. And it will be taught in 2 years again. There is another course on general relativity, applications, to advanced techniques in general relativity and applications to black holes. Those two courses on classical general relativity do not compete with another because they cover rather different topics. Both start from scratch, even though this one is called advanced. Well, not really from scratch. You are supposed to have seen general relativity, of course. But then the applications and the general development is very different. In this course, general relativity, the mathematical foundations and cosmological applications are developed. Here it's all about numerical techniques and applications to black holes. So this is basically abstract math, numerical. This is cosmology, and that's about black holes. Here we have two courses on quantum field theory. One is quantum field theory for cosmology, our course here, and the other one is quantum field theory, which is quantum field theory for particle physics, the traditional kind of quantum field theory. And as I mentioned before, this is all about particle collisions, whereas our course is all about vacuum fluctuations, the effect of horizons, and more the wave character of quantum fields rather than the particle character. But of course, we will also talk about particle creation through expansion and general non-adiabatic processes. And these courses can be taken in arbitrary sequence. None of them is a prerequisite for the other. All right, and about the grades, I already mentioned what the ratios are. Any questions about the formality? No? If not, we can start. Maybe I just show you one picture here. Has anybody seen that picture before? Well, in the middle, it is not a picture taken by a telescope, but it's based on pictures taken by telescopes. In the middle are we, and there are telescopes that have looked in various directions, basically observing slices of the universe, and cataloged galaxies. So what you see here is galaxies that have been recorded. It's not that there are no galaxies here or there, it's just that we haven't recorded them. It's very spotty. In the next picture, you can see better on that. You see, this is when you turn it a little bit, then you see that we looked out in that direction, we looked out in this direction, we looked out like that. And what we see is galaxies distributed like this. Each dot is a galaxy. Each one, 100,000 light years across, roughly by order of magnitude. And what we are after in this course is to explain the distribution of those galaxies ultimately. You can study how the matter is distributed, what is the statistics of that distribution, and you will find it's highly non-trivial. It's not just a uniform distribution. And as I mentioned before, the striking observation has been that the assumption that the origin of the inhomogeneities are quantum fluctuations is very successful in explaining that statistics of the distribution of matter and energy in the universe. There is also a video of that, also produced by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and I have a link to it on my homepage. But the video wouldn't come out on the laptop. It's just, I don't know, it doesn't work. But if your PC is set up properly, then you should be able to see that video, and you can see the distribution of galaxies that have been recorded in a very nice visualization. Okay, so let's get started. Let's begin very easy with a historical background. In the late 1800s, Max Planck started his grad studies. And his supervisor, Scholle, didn't want to take him at first. He said, Planck, you're bright. Why do you do physics? He said, physics is boring because we know the theories there. There's electromagnetism. Maxwell figured that one out at Faraday. And then there's thermodynamics. We know how that works. And classical mechanics we've known for a long time. So basically suggested that it's all been done. And the only things that need to be done in physics are putting more digits of precision to measurement results. But Planck nevertheless insisted and studied physics anyway. And Scholle, the supervisor of Planck, said, you want to do theory. So there's just one little thing that we don't quite understand. And that was black hole, and that was black body radiation. And indeed, it turned out at the turn of the century that classical physics was just not tenable. For three main reasons: black body radiation, the photoelectric effect, and the stability of matter. With black body radiation, as you may be aware, the problem is that if you take electromagnetism and statistical physics together, you should be able to calculate what the spectrum of radiation is that a body at a finite temperature should emit. After all, this body is consisting of charges, positive and negative charges. They will be shaken around by the thermal motion, and so they will be radiating. And one can calculate, one can predict on the basis of classical physics what the spectrum ought to be. Namely, this is what you get. If you calculate, here's the frequency and here's the intensity, if you calculate on the basis of classical physics what the intensity of radiation is, electromagnetic radiation, that those shaken charges of an object will emit, then you find that they will emit little radiation, little electromagnetic radiation of low frequency, but then at higher frequencies, you get more intensity, and in fact, it should just go on like that. It's a polynomial law. And the trouble with this is it couldn't possibly be right, because the higher the frequency, the higher should be the intensity of the emitted light. In other words, anything should cool immediately. You give it some temperature and it will radiate off all of its energy immediately. Essentially, that's because before quantum physics, in classical physics, any system has infinitely many degrees of freedom. And each one wants to have 1/2 kT of the energy available because of thermal motion. And that just won't work if you have infinitely many of them. So you can view it this way, that the electromagnetic field wants to absorb all at 1/2 kT for each of its degrees of freedom. But if they are a continuum of them, then it's just too much. It will suck out the energy right away. So that didn't work. And it took Max Planck to find out that, according to quantum mechanics, according to the idea that he had at this point, which wasn't quantum mechanics yet, but a precursor to it, according to the idea that harmonic oscillators have discrete energy levels, which means that the harmonic oscillators in the electromagnetic field have discrete energy levels, he calculated that the curve should look more like this and then exponentially decay, which matched experiment very well. So the problem that Planck solved was called the ultraviolet catastrophe, because this is the ultraviolet, the high frequencies, which classical physics got completely wrong. And then there was the photoelectric effect. They noticed that using light, you can ionize materials, for example, cesium. Just shine light on it, and you will knock electrons out of it. So far, so good. It's plausible. You shine energy onto something, and then it will ionize. It will rip electrons out of the material. But the problem was that it didn't seem to depend whether this works or not didn't seem to depend on the intensity of the light. It seemed to depend only on the color of the light. Nowadays, of course, we understand that. It's because the color tells us what the energy of the individual photons is. And the intensity just tells us how many of them there are. And if each one of them is having too little energy to liberate an electron, then you could throw as many as you like on it, on the material, and it will not ionize. But at the time, it was very surprising that the amplitude wouldn't help. Increase the amplitude more and more and more, you don't get more ionization. And then certainly there was the issue of the stability of matter. It seems that if you look at, they had found electrons, and the model evolved of the atom as a sort of planetary system with electrons orbiting a nucleus. But this just didn't seem right. How could that possibly be stable? I mean, consider this piece here. I mean, if that was consisting of lots of little planetary systems, why is it I can't bend it? Or why is it it doesn't just flow by? You can't build anything solid out of planetary systems. And in particular, the electrons that orbit the nucleus should be continually radiating off energy, simply because they're accelerated charges, and as such, they act like antennas. They should radiate off energy. And that's what they do, too, initially. But then eventually, they settle on the lowest energy orbit. But why is there a lowest energy? Why doesn't matter collapse? Why don't electrons just fall eventually into the nucleus? And it turned out that the uncertainty principle saves us here. And of course, the uncertainty principle is going to be important also for quantum field theory. Namely, the uncertainty principle says that if the position of something is very much localized, then its momentum fluctuates wildly, which means for the electron that when it gets too close to the nucleus, then its momentum will fluctuate so much that it can escape the nucleus again. So there is a stable distance, which is the Bohr radius. All right, all of these things, of course, vastly contradicted classical physics. And in 1925, Heisenberg discovered non-relativistic quantum mechanics. What he found was, don't think of Schrödinger just yet. Schrödinger came later. So what Heisenberg found was that you can keep the equations of motion. They don't change. The equations of motion stay the same in quantum mechanics. For example, for a harmonic oscillator, this would be the equation of motion, just as usual. M times the acceleration is minus k times the position. But there's an extra little thing that has to be obeyed in quantum mechanics, which is that the position and the momenta do not commute, but instead you have IH bar times the identity on the right side. No? Where?
S double dot.
No. Correct.
So,
Heisenberg found you can keep the equations of motion, but you have to implement that the positions and the momenta do no longer commute. Schrödinger discovered his equation, the Schrödinger equation, half a year later. And that, of course, is the Schrödinger equation. And then a few months later, Dirac showed that this is completely equivalent to what Heisenberg did. But of course, you have to look at it from the point of view of Hilbert spaces to see this, to see that all you do is that you change the time evolution from the Schrödinger picture to the Heisenberg picture, obviously, and that this is just a unitary transformation, and that this is done in the position representation, whereas the previous, the Heisenberg approach doesn't specify any representation. You can do the same thing in even bases independently. Now, let's look at the situation from Heisenberg's perspective, because that will be easier in quantum field theory. We will also cover Schrödinger's point of view in quantum field theory, and we will also cover the Feynman approach to quantum field theory with the path integral. But let us now look at the Heisenberg approach, because this is what gives us the quickest access to quantum field theory. As I said, Heisenberg showed that you can keep the equations of motion, the usual differential equations, but the positions and the momenta have to be non-commutative in a particular way. This so-called quantization implied fundamental changes in the way that physics was done. Mathematically, the fact that the positions and the momenta as functions of time do no longer commute means that the position as a function of time and the momentum as a function of time cannot possibly be number valued, because number valued functions are commutative. Then you can ask, well, what could they be? If they are not number valued, what sort of objects do we have in mathematics that are not commutative? And the easiest thing, and you can show that it's unique, that every other possibility is equivalent to this one, the easiest thing to do is to try to make them matrix valued, or operator valued, or in general, linear map valued. Because linear maps don't generally commute. So the fundamental change mathematically was that the position as a function of time and the momentum as a function of time had to become matrix or operator or map valued functions of time. If you let them act on a Hilbert space, you would call them operators. Physically, there were, of course, also fundamental changes, the most important of which is, of course, the uncertainty principle, which says that the more precisely you know one thing, the more fluctuations you have in its conjugate variable. And those fluctuations are fundamental. The key change to classical physics is that the fluctuations do not express a lack of information on our part. It's not that we just don't know what's going on. It's that it's not fixed what's going on. That's very different from a statistical description of a process that we don't observe with sufficient precision. Here, even with maximum precision, we have incomplete knowledge. Not incomplete knowledge of what's going on, but that just the information just hasn't been generated before. So we see that quantum fluctuations are part of nature, and are not simply measurement fluctuations of the kind that you always encounter when you try to measure something and are not completely precise. However, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, which is this, the commutation relations and the equations of motion. That's the most general way of expressing what Heisenberg discovered. This non-relativistic quantum mechanics soon became unsatisfactory. And by soon, I mean within a matter of years. And the reason is that quantum mechanics, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, is not consistent with special relativity. For example, the typical momentum of an electron, which is in the ground state of a hydrogen atom, corresponds to about 1% of the speed of light. So just take plain, ordinary hydrogen, look at its electron in its ground state. It travels, as far as the notion of velocity makes sense, at about 1% of the speed of light, which means that you should expect in your predictions at least a 1% error if you don't take into account special relativity. And the error may even scale more unfavorably with the speed of light, with the ratio of the speed in question to the speed of light. This is to say that the effects of special relativity were soon spectroscopically measurable. Because you can measure the spectrum, the color of light, with enormous precision. So there was no problem to find deviations from the predictions of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So that means that soon after discovery of quantum mechanics, it was found to be unsatisfactory because it wasn't quite precise. It didn't match experiments. This led for a few years to a search of a relativistic generalization of quantum mechanics. the Dirac equation and the Klein-Gordon equation. They had problems, however, too. Namely, first of all, the energy tends to be not bounded from below in the case of the Dirac equation and the Klein-Gordon equation. There are tricks around that. Dirac invented the Dirac C, and with the Klein-Gordon equation, you can play a similar trick. But it wasn't quite satisfactory. And then unitarity of time evolution was also unclear with those two equations. And finally, a very important shortcoming of the Dirac equation and the Klein-Gordon equation was that they could not explain how particles could ever be created or annihilated. But experimentally, it was observed that you can create particles and annihilate them. The easiest circumstance is, of course, the creation of photons. Accelerate charges, they will create photons. But you can also have that the reverse process where a photon will split into an electron-positron pair. And neutrinos were observed where they weren't any before, and so on. So obviously, there was particle creation and annihilation going on. But there was no way to explain that within quantum mechanics, and also not within its relativistic generalizations. So a new idea was needed. The new idea came from Heisenberg again. And the idea was second quantization in the 1930s. So historically, Heisenberg made the following observation. In quantum mechanics, everything is subject to quantum fluctuations. And therefore, everything has some uncertainty, some fundamental uncertainty attached to it, except for one thing. And that's not a small thing. There's one thing in quantum mechanics which is not subject to quantum fluctuations, and that is the wave function. You see, just like in a classical theory, for example, the theory of sound propagation, or the classical theory of electromagnetism, also in quantum mechanics, non-relativistic or relativistic, if you know the wave function at an early time, you can calculate the wave function later. Or sometimes you may need to know the wave function and its first derivative in time. But in any case, if you have the initial conditions for the wave function, then you can calculate how it will evolve. And there is no uncertainty in how it will evolve. The wave function propagates completely deterministically. And Heisenberg said, well, that's not very quantum mechanical, is it? It's not really in the spirit of quantum mechanics that something would propagate completely deterministically and behave completely deterministically. So he said, well, maybe we should subject quantum mechanics itself to another quantization process, after which even the wave functions will be subject to fluctuations. So he said, all right, let us quantize psi itself. And he said, let us remember that for positions, we had the momenta as conjugate variables. And then there was a non-trivial commutation relation, a non-commutativity between the positions and the momentum. Now, that's been already taken care of by quantum mechanics. But how about quantizing now the wave function? Now, he said, in quantum mechanics, the time derivative of the position variable gives you the corresponding canonically conjugate variable. Well, up to a constant factor of the mass. You just have to put a mass here. But you can absorb that in a rescaling of the unit. So he said, well, maybe the wave functions also have a conjugate variable. And maybe that conjugate variable is also obtained simply by taking the time derivative. Later on, of course, he developed a more sophisticated machinery that we will cover. For how to determine what the conjugate momentum is for a field or a wave function. But initially, the argument was simply, if x has a conjugate variable which is its time derivative, maybe the wave function too has a conjugate variable which is the time derivative of the wave. And then he said, well, if so, then what would be the next step in quantum mechanics? Let's duplicate that too for second quantization. Well, in quantum mechanics, the next step was to take this conjugate variable and postulate that it has a non-trivial commutation relation with the original variable, in this case, the position. So he said, well, we have in quantum mechanics three position variables, xi, which come with conjugate variables, pi, and their commutation relation is like that. Each one is non-commutative only with its own conjugate variable. So here, the wave functions are really a collection of a lot of variables. You see, the x has an index, I, which runs only from 1 to 2 to 3. But the psi has a parameter x, the position, which runs to all of R3. So you have a lot of variables. Just like here, we have three position variables and three conjugate momentum variables. Here, with the psi, we have psi of one position, psi of another position, psi of another position, and so on. Each one of those is a variable. Each one of those has an amplitude. So each one of those is a variable which has a conjugate variable to it. So what he postulated is that just like each x, each position operator has non-trivial commutativity only with its momentum operator, each wave function operator, that is to say for each position where you look at it, has a non-trivial commutation relation with its conjugate momentum operator or variable. So we have that x and x prime label the field and the conjugate field variables. And only when x is equal to x prime is this non-zero. I already used the term operator, of course, because clearly they cannot be number valued anymore. Wave functions cannot be number valued if they are to obey this commutation relation. So it turned out that with this unlikely proposition, Heisenberg was quite successful. With this idea, the problems that had been there before, problems with energy positivity, unitarity, and so on, can be solved. And in particular, also, this theory allows one to calculate the production and annihilation of particles. Let's look at first the mathematical consequences of Heisenberg's idea, and then the physical one. Yes.
I was hoping that you might glance over that. This is to be multiplied with the identity operator.
And in practice, in order to make this mathematically well defined, you would have to smear this over. You would have to multiply things with functions that smear that so that you don't actually have that peak. An alternative way of making this well defined mathematically is to work in momentum space. So you Fourier transform this entire thing, this entire equation. And then if you look at a physical system which has a finite volume, so a box of some large dimension, let's say a box that is 10 billion light years across or 100 billion light years across, then by virtue of its finite volume, we have that the Fourier transform is a Fourier series transform, which is to say that we have only a countable number of momentum values. Whereas here, with the positions, we have a continuum of position values, which is what triggers this to be a delta function rather than a Kronecker delta. However, if you look at the system in momentum space and assume that the system has only a finite volume, then the momentum variables are discretized, which means that you really just get the Kronecker delta on the right hand side. But we will get to that in all detail. But of course, you know, Heisenberg looked at this and had other questions as well, not just mathematical ones, but also physical ones. Because what is this supposed to mean as far as the uncertainty principle is concerned? Does it mean that delta psi, delta pi is larger equal to infinity when x is x prime? No, it doesn't mean that. But in order to make it precise what it means, you have to smear over the positions. All right, so what are the mathematical consequences of Heisenberg's assumption there? Mathematically, first of all, it's clear that what became of the wave function, this psi hat and the pi hat, certainly can no longer be number valued. And for each position and time, the value here, this thing can only be an operator on a Hilbert space. It has to be something non-commutative anyway. What happens to the equations of motion? Well, remember Heisenberg's original discovery of quantum mechanics. He showed that you can keep the equations of motion. All you have to do is to make the variables non-commuting in a particular way with their conjugate variables. So he kept that strategy and simply said, well, we keep the equations of motion of phi, of psi, and pi. So if psi obeyed the Schrödinger equation before, we wanted to obey it later as well. If it obeyed the Klein-Gordon equation, it's still to obey the Klein-Gordon equation. No change at all. The only change we want is that it's non-commutative with its derivative, with its time derivative. So the equations of motion are not what creates the trouble. It's the non-commutativity that does. By trouble, I mean mathematical difficulty, not inconsistency. Now, what are the consequences for the physics then? Well, this is, of course, what Heisenberg was after. Well, we get an uncertainty relation like this now. And that's because you can prove on general functional analytic grounds that whenever you have self-adjoint operators A and B that obey some commutation relation, doesn't matter what is on the right-hand side. Could be an IH bar, but it could also be something much more complicated than this. Then you can derive from this that delta A, delta B is larger equal to 1/2 the absolute value of the expectation value of the commutator of A and B. This holds on general grounds. So in particular, it holds for the fields. Of course, this delta function here is a little bit annoying, but as we will see, one can deal with that. Basically, well, maybe let me just indicate briefly how you can do it. Here we have here's the commutation relation. So this, for fixed x, you can take as an A, and for fixed B, for a fixed x prime, you can use the pi hat as a B, and then you end up with an uncertainty relation, which looks like this, which doesn't really make much sense because it's zero or infinity on the right hand side. But what you can do is you can define new variables, one variable being, for example, integral d3x. And then it's some smearing function, which you may call s of x times, we call it psi, psi hat of x and t. So if this s of x is chosen wisely, for example, some function that is zero most of the time, and then it goes up to some finite value, and then it smoothly goes to zero again. Okay, this could be s of x. And then you define a b, d3x, and some other function like that. I don't know, r of x, and then pi hat of x and t, where r is also of that kind, doesn't have to be the same, just something, then you can calculate what the commutator is between A and B, and you find it's no longer a distribution. The commutator between the A and the B is going to be something nice. On the right-hand side, there's no distribution anymore because you have integrals, which will eat up the delta function. And then you can calculate what the delta A, delta B uncertainty relation is. And it will make sense. So it just means that you're not looking at the field psi hat at one particular place, but you're looking at the average of psi hat smeared over a finite region. And similarly for the momentum. What you see, of course, also is that if you choose your R to have support where S doesn't, then the A will contain psi hats that will commute with the pi hats that are contained in the B, and the uncertainty relations will be just trivial. Okay, so this is what is meant by a smeared version of commutation and uncertainty relation. But from this, you see, even though as it stands, it cannot be interpreted easily, it gives you an idea of what's going on. So what are the new phenomena that are now predicted and described? First of all, regarding particles, what should we expect? We should expect to be able to describe particle creation and annihilation processes. Now, what's the intuition for that? Why would we expect this? Well, remember that the norm, that the wave function now is no longer just a number-valued function. The wave function in quantum mechanics has to be normalized. But this thing is not even number-valued. How can you normalize this thing? It's not normalized. But why would you normalize a wave function in quantum mechanics? You normalize it to one being the number of particles that the wave function describes. If you have in non-relativistic quantum mechanics several particles, then for each particle you have its wave function of norm one. But here, the wave function doesn't have to be normalized. In fact, the very norm of the wave function doesn't make sense. So the particle number need not be expected to be conserved. The probability for finding a particle here or there or there or there doesn't have to add up to one. It could be more, it could be less. In principle, that is what should be allowed, and we will see that quantum field theory allows that. It even allows states in which the number of particles is not integer. We should also predict the existence of antiparticles here. The negative energy or negative mass particles that had plagued relativistic quantum mechanics in this formalism can be interpreted as particles propagating backwards in time. And then when we interpret them as propagating backwards in time, then they are just like ordinary particles, but all their quantum numbers are opposite. Because whatever a quantum number means, for example, an attractive force, the charge is a quantum number, then if you follow that backward in time, then an attraction becomes a repulsion becomes an attraction. So all the quantum numbers are reversed. What should we expect regarding waves? Well, even in the lowest energy state, even when there are no particles present, even in the vacuum, we should now expect the presence of particles, the presence of fields, the presence of fluctuations of particles and fields. And that's just because the absence of anything in quantum mechanics would be described, we don't usually do it, but if you wanted to describe it, it would be described by a wave function, which is zero everywhere. Okay? No probability to find a particle anyway. Wave function is vanishing. But in second quantization, that's just not enough. When you have the vacuum state, then even though the expectation value of the field may be zero everywhere, so I'm just writing symbolically here the vacuum state, and then the what happens to, or what became of the wave function, this psi hat, this operator, even if we enforce that the expectation value is zero, in general, as we will see, this doesn't mean that the expectation value of psi squared, which gives us the uncertainty in psi, is also vanishing. In general, it won't vanish. In fact, as we will soon see, it cannot vanish because that would require infinite energy. Paradoxically, in quantum field theory, once you do the second quantization, you will find, and we will see that in the lecture or two, that if you wanted to write down a state in which the in which you are sure to find the field amplitude zero everywhere, you can write down that state, but it would have infinite energy. So whenever you have only a finite energy budget, and we always have, and nature always has, apparently, then that state is not available. Which is to say that at finite energy, there is always fluctuations of fields. This is a plot of a calculation of quantum fluctuations. And within a lecture or two, you should be able to do this yourself. Calculate what a typical fluctuating field would look like. So if you measured a psi hat of x at a particular point in time, if you could measure that amplitude, then if the field were, for example, in the vacuum state, if the system was in the vacuum state, then what would you expect for the amplitude? That's the typical draw from the probability distribution. I should say that this original point of view of Heisenberg was not taught for many years, because in accelerators, you never see this. Okay. In accelerators, all you see is particles going into the collision, and then other particles coming out of the collision. And there has been a school of thought, pedagogical school of thought, which holds that you should never even mention the history of quantum field theory, which is what I just told you about, because it was seen as misleading to even talk about these things, because all you ever see in a detector is particles going in, crashing, and then particles coming out. So you never see any waves. Now, the situation has changed over the past 10 years or so because of cosmology. Because such quantum fluctuations, not particles, but the fluctuations of quantum fields, are thought to have been the origin of all inhomogeneity in the universe, which is to say that actually the universe made a measurement just like that in principle. And those fluctuations have been imprinted on the sky, so that we actually see a picture like that indirectly, because there's plasma physics in between. But we see a picture like that when we look at the cosmic microwave effect on the sky. And this means that it has become important to resurrect that point of view and to study what the fluctuations fields are in quantum field theory, and in particular in the presence of gravity, where the fluctuations of fields mean fluctuations of energy, of course, and the fluctuations of energy mean fluctuations of curvature. And those fluctuations of curvature mean fluctuations of redshift. When we see the photons coming from the cosmic microwave background, we see them with fluctuating redshift. That is the fluctuating temperature that we see. And that ultimately traces back to fluctuations of the fields, fluctuations of their energy, fluctuations of their curvature, and fluctuations of the redshift.
Yeah. If we say that the wave function is an uncertain quantity, then can we even say that psi is zero? I mean, we cannot even say
for certainty that psi would be zero?
Well, the situation is just like in a regular quantum mechanics, where the position operator, for example, is an operator now, which means it's not number values. However,
it has eigenvalues, it has expectation values, it has standard deviations that you can calculate. And the idea is you can do similar things with fields. You can calculate the expectation value of the field, you can calculate the expectation value of phi squared, and you can calculate the energy expression, expectation value. You, out of the fields and the conjugate fields, you can build the Hamiltonian, for example. The Hamiltonian density, you can calculate its expectation value as a function of space and time, and so on. So in order to get observables, you proceed in principle the same way you did in ordinary first quantization. Take expectation values, eigenvalues, and so on. So the aim of this course is to introduce second quantization, quantum field theory, and to study field fluctuations, just like the picture I drew there, and in particular to study that in the presence of horizons and gravity. The reason being that at the end of the day, we want to cover the cosmic microwave background. Here's just here's the last slide. The inflationary scenario goes back to roughly 1980. The first paper on inflation was, I think, in 1979 or 78 by Englea and Braut and somebody whose name I don't remember now. But that model was not quite covering all the aspects yet. And then in the early 80s, all the pieces were put together. And nowadays, we believe that we have a pretty good theory that would explain how from initial inhomogeneities of fields, inhomogeneities in the condensation of hydrogen occurred, and then that hydrogen inhomogeneity, the density, the inhomogeneous density of the primordial hydrogen, eventually, over time, meant that hydrogen would coalesce into stars and galaxies, which then ignited, and then you have the very early, you have the early universe, and then eventually you have the distribution of galaxies that we see today. Those steps we will not cover in this course. This is complicated astrophysics, which is, of course, a big industry nowadays. But we won't cover it here because it has nothing to do with quantum field theory. And quantum field theory is only entering in the very first step. And that's the step that we want to cover at the end. All right. We're done for today. Do you have any questions?
No questions at all? Well, if there are no questions, then let's
finish off today. If you want, have a look at the three textbooks that I recommended and lecture notes. And remember that on Thursday, the class starts at 5, not at 4. Always Mondays at 4, and sorry, not Mondays, Tuesdays at 4 and Thursdays at 5. Okay? See you Thursday.